I always sit on the front row, and I pull my family in with me. And so our kids are in the front row, and I used to have some anxiety around my kids. You see, kids are kids, right? They play like kids, they sit in service like kids. And I remember maybe about 3 or so months in, my son, who was about 6 years old, 5 years old at that time, grabbed a couple of his buddies. So, you know, I'm thinking about preaching. My wife was in the nursery. I'm in the front. And I've got like something like 300 kids. I mean, it felt like that, but it was like three. Like three kids in the front row. And then my daughter's too. So maybe 5 or 6 kids, and they're all in the front with me. And during worship, my son and the two other boys, they lay upside down on the pew, put their feet over the back. And during worship, they are singing their little hearts out. Do you know how 5-year-olds worship? Like that. And ever since then, that kind of anxiety I had about it, it just went away, and just realized kids are kids, and we love our kids, don't we? So I'm thankful for the ministry that you guys have here, and you are pouring into these kids and pouring Jesus into these kids, and we can see it. We can see that. If you have your Bibles, we're going to be in Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. I'd love for you to follow along with me. We're going to leave off a little bit, or start where we left off a little bit in Matthew, because I'd like to give you some context before we start to dive into chapter 18. Chapter 16 is a pivotal moment in Jesus' ministry. As soon as chapter 16 concludes, the whole concept or feel of the book of Matthew shifts. And it ends with this idea where what we talked about a couple nights ago, where in chapter 16, Jesus asks his disciples, who do people say that I am? And the disciples say Elijah, the prophets. And then Jesus looks at Peter and says, what about you? Who do you say that I am? And then Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus says, you are right when you say this. In fact, on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome the church. It's got to be a great moment for Peter, because Jesus is saying, hey, who is the Messiah? And Peter's like, you're the Messiah. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, as a pastor, the moment I have somebody who acknowledges Jesus as Lord, you know what I want to tell them? Go and tell everybody you know about it. We've been hearing a good bit about the Great Commission. And that is at the tail end of Matthew. But I want to point a verse out to you, because right after Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, verse 20, chapter 16, verse 20, that's where we're picking up, says this, then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he's the Messiah. Now, I don't know about you, but that seems backwards in my mind. See, this is not what I call the Great Commission. This is the Great Omission. This is the moment when Peter gets the answer right and Jesus says, okay, now don't tell anybody. Why would Jesus tell his disciples not to tell anyone about him? Well, you see, I believe it's because it's one thing to believe that Jesus is the Messiah. It's another thing to understand the type of Messiah that Jesus came to be. You see, they did not understand the Messiah that Jesus came to be. In fact, you see in the very next section, in verses 21 down through verse 28, you've got Jesus who's looking at Peter and says, let me tell you the Messiah that I've come to be. See, I'm the bleeding, suffering, dying Messiah. I'm going to go to a cross. I'm going to die. I'm going to give my life away. That's who I am. That's the kind of Messiah I came to be. And Peter says, my Lord, this will never happen to you. And then Jesus, remember these words? He says, get behind me, Satan, for you do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of man. See, Peter could not accept the type of Messiah that Jesus came to be. You see it unfold further in chapter 17. Chapter 17, Jesus and his disciples go up on the mountain. Peter, of course, is with them. When they get up on the mountain, Jesus is transfigured before them. And then Peter looks at Jesus and says, oh, it is good for us to be here. Let me create three shelters. And then notice, then it's, while he's still speaking, this is in verse 5 of chapter 17. He says, while he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from that cloud said, this is my son whom I love, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. This morning I mentioned, you know, God has a sense of humor. I think there's a sense of humor in that passage, because while Peter is speaking, the heavens are open, and it's like God's saying, be quiet, Peter. You know why? Because Jesus is not the kind of Messiah who stays on the mountaintop. He's the Messiah that comes back down to the valley. You see, if he was the God who stayed up on the mountaintop, he would never have come in a manger to begin with. You see, he's the kind of Messiah who's going to humble himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Again, everything that spills out now is about this cross. It's about who Jesus is as the Messiah. You see, in verse 22, he predicts his death again. As you, and we're going to get to chapter 18, but then you get into chapter 19, chapter 20, and everything is about this dying on a cross. And in verse 30 of chapter 19 says, but many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. Chapter 20, verse 16. So the last will be first, and the first will be last. Chapter 20, verse 25. Jesus called them together and said, you know, the rulers of the Gentiles rule it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. See, everything Jesus is going to be teaching from this moment on, it's about the cross. What does it look like to live under the cross? It's to not be first, but to be last. You know, if you watch Jesus' life, John chapter 6 is, a great example of this. He feeds 5,000 men, which means about 12,000 to 20,000 people, including women and children. And what he does is he does this miracle where he multiplies the bread and the fish. Now, if Jesus was about himself, if you're someone who can multiply bread and fish, wouldn't the smart idea be to start a restaurant and make millions? But that's not who Jesus is. That's not the kind of Messiah he came to be. This has actually really been, it's been bothering me. Because Jesus never thought about himself. He never put himself first. And it really bothers me because you know how often I think of myself? He never thought about himself. He never put himself first. He always thought of you first. He humbled himself to the lowest point. He never thought of himself. See, that's our Messiah, the type of Messiah Jesus came to be. Now, with that in mind, chapter 18, it's all about the cross. Chapter 18, verses 1 through 5, and I would also include verses 6 through 9. You have this section where Jesus is preaching on sin. And the essence of this section is sin is a big deal. Don't treat sin lightly. Sin is a big deal. You see that because in verse 8 he says, if your hand or foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life maimed or crippled than to have two hands or two feet and be thrown in the fire of hell. It's his way of saying, listen, hey, sin is a big deal. The question is, why is sin a big deal? Do you know that sin, contained within sin, is the seed of destruction? The consequence of sin is baked into the recipe of sin. In what way? Sin always separates you from God, and it always separates you from other people. That is the very nature and character of sin in every single sense. It always separates you from God, and it separates you from others. It's really easy examples of this. You have, for example, pride. Have you ever met someone with just pride seeping from their fingertips? And have you ever looked at them and said, oh, they're my favorite person. I love how prideful they are. No, probably not. What about hatred? Somebody's just, man, they just hate my guts. Man, I love how much they hate my guts. That doesn't make sense, does it? Here's an easy one. Murder. Could you imagine how murder would separate you from relationship with that person? Probably. Slander. You never grew closer to somebody because you were slandering them or they were slandering you, unless you're the one that's forgiving, right? See, slander, lying. You can't have relationship with somebody when you're lying to them. You can't have it. It always separates you. That's what sin always does. Sin always, always separates. And Jesus says, hey, sin is a big deal. See, contained within sin is the seed of destruction. And it's interesting because you hear people think in terms of, like, I'm living in sin, and so then they think that after they've lived in sin for a certain amount of time, that God is punishing them for their sin. You know, God doesn't have to punish you for your sin. Sin does that already. It's like the person who smokes for their entire life, and then they say after smoking for 40 years, God decided to punish me by giving me cancer. It's like, no, God has been screaming and yelling at you that this is not good for you. It's not good for your body. And so that's what sin does. See, contained within sin is the seed of destruction. So this is the idea. Sin is a big deal. Now the question, we have to ask the question, verses 10 through 14. What is God's response to sin? What is God's response when you sin against him? And you have this in the form of a parable. And in the form of this parable, this is the parable of the wandering sheep, or the 100 sheep, and that there's 100 sheep that are in the sheep pen, and one sheep wanders off. That one sheep represents the person who sins against God, who walks away from God. And you know God's response to that one sheep that wanders off? He forgives them. And he pursues that one sheep. You know, if you look back into Genesis and Adam and Eve, do you remember when Adam and Eve sin against God? I used to think that God hid from Adam and Eve. But did you know that if you read closely, God never hides his face from Adam and Eve? It's Adam and Eve that hide from God. Do you know God is always pursuing? When Adam and Eve sin, there's a term in chapter 3 that we use for their sin. It's called the fall. If we call sin the fall, it then begs the question, how far did they fall? It's a really important question. There's actually quite a bit of debate on this concept within the church. Some people believe that when Adam and Eve fell, when they sinned against God, they hit rock bottom. As far as you could possibly go, that they hit so far that they had no capacity for love, no ability to respond to God, because they had fallen to the absolute lowest possible state that they could have fallen. There's another tradition, which is represented here at this camp, that believes that before, when Adam and Eve sinned, before they hit rock bottom, God caught them. He prevented them from hitting rock bottom. And the term we use for that is prevenient grace. I tell you these two distinctions within the church not to argue the theology of which one is better, but to express to you that whether you believe God, that when they fell, they hit rock bottom, or before they hit rock bottom, God caught them, that in both instances, God is always the first initiator. God is always the one who is pursuing you and reaching out to you. Do you know tonight, before you even came here tonight, God has been working on you, that God has, in his prevenient grace, he has paved a road for you to show up in this moment and in this hour to hear what God has to say. Boy, doesn't that just change your perspective of what's happening in this moment? When you realize God has been working with you in your life for this moment. Prevenient grace. See, how does God respond to someone who sins? He forgives them and he pursues them and he comes after them. There's a concept in the scriptures called the unforgivable sin. If you were to read Hebrews, there are a variety of warnings or passages in Hebrews that say, be careful, because if you continue to resist God, you can get to a point where you can't turn back. Do you know the unforgivable sin is an unforgivable sin not because God has given up on you? It's because you've said no to him so much that you have gotten to a place where you've given up on God. God is always, always, always pursuing you. He's always offering forgiveness. That is our God. So, sin is a big deal. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off, throw it away. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out, throw it away. Sin is a big deal. How does God respond to you when you sin against God? He loves you. He pursues you. He forgives you. But now it begs the question, if that's God's response towards sin, what should our response be when someone else sins against me? And that is exactly what Jesus responds to and answers in verses 15 down through verse 17. He says this, if your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you have won them over. But if they will not listen, take one or two others along so that the matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If they refuse to listen, tell it to the church. If they refuse to listen, even to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. I always read this verse like this. Someone sins against me, so I talk to them. They don't listen to me, so I take it to two or three others. They don't listen to the two or three others, so I take it to the church. They don't listen to the church, then I treat them as I would a pagan or a tax collector. And in my mind, what that meant was, oh, I can finally kick them to the curb. That's what I thought. How did Jesus treat the tax collector and the sinner? Like the one sheep that wandered off, he pursued him. He ate with the tax collectors and sinners. He loved him. He pursued him. Do you know what it means? If someone sins against you and you forgive them, and you talk to them and they still won't listen to you, they still won't listen to you, what it comes down to is you treat them as you would a pagan or tax collector, which is love them more. Okay? So now, you're looking at me and you're saying, you've got a question in your mind. This is like a preacher, like one of the things we try to do is presume we know the questions you're asking when you're sitting there, because we can't always do Q&A. I'm presuming you have a question in your mind. You're going to ask me if God's response to sin is he forgives you, he pursues you, he comes after you. If our response is treat him as a pagan or tax collector, forgive the person, love the person, then you're going to ask, okay, hold on, Corey, how many times should I forgive my brother or sister when they sin against me? And I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, 7 times. Sounds pretty good. How about 7 times? Some of you may know I'm toying a little bit, because the disciples, they know what Jesus is talking about is forgiveness. They know that what it means to treat someone as a pagan or a tax collector is to forgive them. Why do I know that? Because in verse 21, Peter comes to Jesus and says, how many times should I forgive my brother or sister when they sin against me? Up to seven times? And then Jesus answered, not seven times, but 77 times. Or some translations, 70 times seven. And by the way, the point is not to do the math and find out how many times until you can finally kick them to the curb. The point is, never stop forgiving them. Luke even says, you got to forgive them. You got to forgive them. Even if it's seven times a day, which is a ridiculous amount of times to forgive somebody. That is always God's heart. To forgive, to forgive, to forgive. Sin is a big deal. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. If your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. How does God treat you when you sin against God? He loves you. He forgives you. He pursues you. What happens when someone sins against you? There's a process, a good process, a process meant for redemption. The person doesn't respond to that entire process. Treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. Love them. How many times am I going to do that? Seven times? Not seven times, but 77 times, or seven times seven. I'm so convinced that this is the heart of God, that we literally have to walk across his blood to get to hell. That our entire way, we will have to kick and scream, and Jesus is going to be at the gates of hell itself saying, don't go that way. Because he loves you. Because he loves you. Because he loves you. You know, I have a friend about 4 years ago. I did get permission to tell this story. And my friend's name is Michael. And 4 years ago, his father-in-law, he had married this girl. It really was 14 years ago. So about for 10 years, he had tried to be in relationship with her father-in-law, or his father-in-law, I mean, her dad. And tension was rising. The father-in-law didn't like Michael. And he believed and said it outright. He said, my authority as a father outweighs your authority as a husband. And every chance he got, he tried to separate and wiggle his way in between the marriage to get them to divorce. It got so bad that one day, my friend, from whatever the situation was, triggered him, and they got into a shouting match. His exact words to me were, he said, Corey, you don't understand. When I say I was angry, when I tell you I hated him, I mean I saw red in my eyes. For 3 weeks, he was so angry that he said he could not sleep at night. He said at best he got 2 hours of sleep at any given time, and he was so absolutely exhausted. 3 weeks in, and every couple of days he'd call me for just a talk, for counseling, for a friend. And then finally, after 3 weeks, he was so desperate for sleep, he went down to the local liquor store, bought as much alcohol as he could, and he drank himself to sleep. He woke up 4 hours later in what he described was some of the most unrestful sleep he had. And he calls me that morning, hungover, and he says, Corey, I don't know what to do. Every time I close my eyes, I see his face, I see blood in my eyes, and I hate him. And I looked at I was on the phone, so I told my friend, I said, you have to forgive him. You understand there's a difference between forgiveness, and there's a step after forgiveness, which is reconciliation. Forgiveness is on your end. Even if reconciliation, which takes two, even if reconciliation cannot happen, and there's a lot of complication around reconciliation, but forgiveness is always on your end. You should always forgive. And I told him, you've got to forgive him. And he said, I don't know how. So I said, go grab a piece of paper. So he did. He sat down, and I said, start to write him a letter. Even if you don't send it, start writing him a letter. And start writing the words, I forgive you. He started to write these words, I forgive you. And by the time he finished those few words, I forgive you, he broke down crying. I didn't hear a word he said for 5 minutes. He broke down crying, and he said, and then he just started mumbling. He said, I've got to go. He hung up the phone. I got a call. 2 days later, he calls me, and he says, I just woke up. Which is wild. He said he was holding on to this bitterness and this hatred toward his stepfather. And the moment that he forgave his stepfather, all that weight just came off. And I'm not saying it always happens that way, exactly like that. But what I am telling you is that God's heart for you is that he forgives you. And our response when other people wrong us should always be to forgive. I think it's been about 4 years, maybe 5 years ago. My wife and I were coming home from Indianapolis, Indiana. We were going to Marion. We were going through this little town called Elwood. There was a stoplight there, the one stoplight that city has. I think it'd be a town. Either way, very small. We stopped there, semi in front of us, and I'm in the passenger seat. My wife is driving. We've got our three kids in the car seats. One of our kids was, my daughter, Kira, was 4 months old at this point, and never saw it coming. There was a woman on methamphetamine that hit us going 55 miles an hour in a Dodge pickup truck. Smashed us between the semi. Broke my daughter's legs, and I got knocked out, and it was devastating. We had about a year in which we were processing this car accident, and before we had ever met this woman, the woman that hit us, and we were processing it and we're praying through it, and I remember about a year later, she finally goes to court, and they tell us as the victims to come to the court to the court case and to speak like what we want, right? And so when we get there, the judge says that the minimum is 6 years. And that could be 6 years in prison, that could be 6 years in recovery, that could be 6 years, there's a variety of different things. And after about a year, I finally had an opportunity, my wife and I had finally had an opportunity to speak our minds, well, how we really felt about her. And we get up on the stand, and we do the whole oath thing, and what I said next, I'm not sure it was appropriate, but we looked at her, and we said, we want you to know that for the last year, we love you and we forgive you. And our church, we gathered our church around, and for a year we prayed for her, and we said, we want you to know our church has been praying for you, and we hope that when you get out of wherever you end up going, that you come to our church. What I didn't realize is that afterwards she was sent to a home, and the home that she was sent to, it was like, three-fourths of the people that worked there were friends of mine from Indiana Wesleyan that had graduated from there. And she was so loved and witnessed to, she came to know Jesus, and to this day, her life is thriving. What she did, it hurt our family. But I don't know any other response but to forgive. And the only reason I know that as a response is because he first forgave me. He has always pursued me. He has always loved us and come after us and been good to us. Tonight, every single person here, I guarantee you, has been sinned against. Every single person here has been wronged. There are some people here, perhaps, that don't feel the forgiveness that God is offering. Do you know that the forgiveness Jesus offers you, it is freely extended to you? It's just up to you whether you want to live in that forgiveness he's already given you. In fact, you know, I think it's Luke's gospel when there's four buddies lower a guy down, and Jesus looks at this invalid, and instead of healing him, the first words he says is, son, sins are forgiven. That phrase is in the indicative, which means it's a statement of fact. In other words, Jesus looks at this man, and instead of saying, I forgive you, he says, son, sins are forgiven. It's his way of saying, listen, this is God's posture towards you is forgiveness. God is freely offering his forgiveness. Would you embrace that tonight? If you have been sinned against tonight and you have been wronged, and like I said, everyone here has been, would you join in a posture of prayer of forgiveness toward those who have wronged you? You know, the only way in which you can forgive somebody is if they're the ones who wronged you. Would you hold that posture? The same posture God has offered to you and extended to you, would you extend it to the people around you? Tab, would you go ahead and come? And in a moment, we're going to open up the altars. God loves you because he loves you because he loves you. Would you offer forgiveness to whoever it might be? And most of the time, in my experience, it's often in the family. For those who have wronged against you, I realize reconciliation doesn't always happen, but would you extend forgiveness? Jesus. You have proclaimed forgiveness in our lives. When we walked away from you, when we sinned against you, you sent your one and only Son to die on a cross, to come and not to be first, but to be last. Not to live on a mountain, but to come down to the valley. You sent your Son to offer forgiveness to a world. And tonight, Jesus, we have all been wronged. We have all been sinned against. May we pray forgiveness over those who've wronged us. There are people here who are going to churches that are struggling with forgiveness. There are people here who are going to churches where there is conflict within the church, dividing, separating, devastating. Jesus, would you work in and through those congregations to bring forgiveness about? Tonight, I'm going to ask those who want to ask for Jesus to forgiveness to come. With every head bowed and every eye closed, I'm going to ask some of those who have been wronged to come and offer forgiveness to those who have wronged you. But I'm also going to ask tonight for those who are at churches, who represent churches that are going through conflict, would you pray forgiveness over your church tonight? Forgiveness and reconciliation that only God can bring. The altars are open. Would you come?
Of my bondage, sorrow and night, Jesus, I come. Jesus, I come into thy freedom, gladness and light. Jesus, I come to thee. Out of my sickness, into thy health, out of my want, and into thy wealth. Out of my sin and into thyself, Jesus, I come to thee. Out of my shameful failure and loss, Jesus, Jesus, I come. Jesus, I come into thy glorious gain of thy cross. Jesus, I come to thee. Out of my sorrow into thy bond, out of life's storms and into thy calm. Out of distress to jubilant song, Jesus, I come to thee. Out of unrest and arrogant pride, Jesus, I come. Jesus, I come. Oh, into thy blessed will to obey, Jesus, I come to thee. Out of myself to dwell in thy love, out of despair into raptures above, upward for aeon wings like a dove. Jesus, I come to thee. Coming home, coming home, nevermore to roam. Open wide thy arms of love, Lord, I'm coming home. Coming home, coming home, nevermore to roam. Open wide thine arms of love, Lord, I'm coming home. Lord, I'm coming home.
You know, in the book of Corinthians, we read that those we forgive are forgiven indeed by God. Do you know, as a church, we're the ones who are called to proclaim forgiveness in our world? What that means is that you're the voice of forgiveness in your family. You're the voice of forgiveness in your church. Would you go and speak forgiveness to a world that is desperately looking for forgiveness? To a world that has the weight of sin and needs to hear a message that they are forgiven indeed. Jesus, may we proclaim forgiveness when there is conflict, when there is sin. May we be the voice of redemption. Jesus, be with us tonight as we go from this place to be a people forgiven so that we may be a people that forgive. We pray this in your name. Amen. May you go tonight in his grace and forgiveness. You are sent.
Because you were forsaken, I'm accepted. You were condemned. I'm alive and well. Your spirit is within me. Because you died and rose again. Amazing love, how can it be that you, my King, would die for me? Amazing love, I know it's true, and it's my joy to honor you in all I do. I worship you in all I do. I worship you. Amazing love, how can it be that you, my King, would die for me? Amazing love. It's my joy to honor you in all I do. I honor you in all I do. I honor you. Are my King. Amazing love, how can it be that you, my King, would die for me? Amazing love, I know it's true, and it's my joy to honor you. And all I do, I honor.